I want to do a series on gender politics and gender equality, and more specifically some ideas I have about how I think we might be able to move things forward. I would like to start with a quote.
The gender revolution is one of the most important changes that's ever happened in human culture. Its core intentions, its core missions, are undeniably needed. Now that we are 70 years into it, in some areas the gender revolution continues to progress. However, in other areas progress has slowed or stalled. Worse, in some areas we are going backwards. After 70 years, the finish line is nowhere in sight. I believe it's time we considered why our progress is faltering, and what needs to change to bring about the next wave of the movement. At the broadest level, I suggest that historically we've mostly focused on articulating and dealing with the problems after they've happened. What we need to do now is shift our attention to what's causing the problems in the first place. This is going to take us into some radical and sometimes uncomfortable new territory, but it will lead us more directly to the just world we seek.
The gender revolution is one of the most important changes that's ever happened in human culture. Its core intentions, its core missions, are undeniably needed. Now that we are 70 years into it, in some areas the gender revolution continues to progress. However, in other areas progress has slowed or stalled. Worse, in some areas we are going backwards. After 70 years, the finish line is nowhere in sight. I believe it's time we considered why our progress is faltering and what needs to change to bring about the next wave of the movement. At the broadest level, I suggest that historically we've mostly focused on articulating and dealing with the problems after they've happened. What we need to do now is shift our attention to what's causing the problems in the first place. This is going to take us into some radical and sometimes uncomfortable new territory, but it will lead us more directly to the just world we seek.
The gender revolution is one of the most important changes that's ever happened in human culture. Its core intentions, its core missions are undeniably needed. Now that we're 70 years into it, in some areas the gender revolution continues to progress. However, in other areas, progress has slowed or stalled. Worse, in some areas, we're going backwards. After 70 years, the finish line is nowhere in sight. I believe it's time we considered why our progress is faltering and what needs to change to bring about the next wave of the movement. At the broadest level, I suggest that historically, we've mostly focused on articulating and dealing with the problems after they've happened. What we need to do now is shift our attention to what's causing the problems in the first place. This is going to take us into some radical and sometimes uncomfortable new territory, but it will lead us more directly to the just world we seek. So you've probably worked out by now that that quote is mine, and maybe you're wondering why I led you through those three readings of it. The reason, dear listener, is to reflect on our potential biases. So I am socialized male with male privileges and male blind spots. And even more specifically, I am an old, white, cis male. And here I am doing a series on gender equality and some ideas on potential directions for the next wave of the gender revolution. To be blunt about it, people like me are not generally who we think of with regards to talking to this topic. So it's sort of a gender flip of the problem that most of us are familiar with, the problems that women face in areas like politics, business, economics, technology, trades, etc., etc., etc. There is a resistance there, which is unfair and unjust. Women have to fight harder, make better points, do more perfect presentations, just generally be unrealistically perfect in those areas to get the same level of listenership and audience as men do. And the area I'm dabbling in this series is the opposite of that. The fight for me in this space is harder, and I just wanted to draw your awareness to that possibility before we begin. Case in point, I've been speaking and writing to aspects of this topic for 3 decades now, and I actually used to write under a gender-neutral pen name just because I found that people would give me more credibility and would move less towards disagreement. So, with that done, I've actually brought in two friends, and I would like to welcome them here today. Perhaps let's just say hello.
Hi.
How are you doing, you two? What's your name? What's your gender? And how are you doing today? Emma?
Hi, I'm Emma. I identify as she, her. Well, those are my pronouns. I'm doing great. I'm doing sick and tired, actually, but I'm doing great. Glad, very glad to be here, to be part of this little revolution. And I think it's really important. I think it's right that it, these topics get delved into a lot more than they have been.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. Inga.
G'day. I'm Inga. I use she and they pronouns. I show up in the world and am read mostly as a woman. I'm doing good. This is a really intriguing space and one that's close to me, as I have people in my life who are men or read as men who have definitely been at the effect of not being heard on things like feelings and some of the trauma that they've had at the hands of people and women because they're men and they should toughen up. So I'm really interested in what you have to say here.
Super. Thank you both. I've invited you in for this because I've been wanting to do something like this series for the longest time, and I did have a go at doing it as a monologue, but if it was a little bit torturous for me to listen back to, then I can just imagine the special form of hell it would have been for listeners. So what I'm hoping for here is sort of something between like a conversation and something between a workshop, like a funny little bespoke private workshop just for the three of us that 20,000 people are listening to.
I have been referred to as a workshop junkie a lot, so this is perfect place for me.
Wowee, have you come to the right place.
I know.
And I've chosen the two of you because you are intelligent. In my opinion, you care for all people. And I think you can also think out the box. Like, I find you've both got very flexible thinking around all topics, but this one in particular.
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks. Yep.
I know that like between the three of us at various times, we've discussed very little small parts of this content, but for the most part, it's a pretty cold start. You haven't heard much of what I'd like to discuss here. And feel free to jump in and ask me questions, help clarify things that don't make sense, bring in points if it feels right to do so. We're sort of all making this up as we go, and that's perfect. I'm not assuming that your presence here means that you're in agreement with anything I say, and nor will the listener, because listeners are great like that. And I'm also giving you editing rights. So, like, if there's anything, you know, this is these are tricky, complicated areas sometimes. So, if there's anything you say that you're uncomfortable with, you just let me know and I cut that out.
Yep.
Okay. And I'd also just like to say thank you both for joining me in this and for caring about this topic.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah, I feel glad to be involved. I think it's the more we discuss these sorts of things, the better it is. And yeah, I feel delighted to be part of it.
Super. So my plan is to, this is obviously our hello and intro kind of episode, and I want to spend most of the rest of our time today working with a case example of the problem of male violence and move on from there to sort of articulate what I opened up in those opening quotes. And then going forwards from there, we'll do a deep dive into the concept of privilege and ways that we might extend the current understanding around that topic. Then after that, I'd love to look into toxic masculinity, not just because it's awesome, but because that could potentially be a really radical tool for change. Next topic after that will be around the benefits and shortfalls of gender separate spaces, and how counterintuitively they can actually contribute to the problems we're trying to solve.
Yep.
I'd love to talk about patriarchy. I'd love to talk around the gender pay gap, and some stuff around employment economics and female underrepresentation. I'd like to talk about the ways that the world is built around male sexuality, but also the ways that it isn't, and how that could be really helpful information for us. And then I'd like to finish with tying that all together a little bit and working out like where to from here, like what do things look like if we find that there's much truth or much of interest in what we've been discussing, what's the path forwards from there?
Sounds juicy.
So a casual afternoon chat.
just easy topics.
Yep. And shout out to the people that listen to the podcast as a way of falling to sleep. You might want to choose a different episode.
Maybe.
Gender equality story time with Emma, Inga and Rog. Once upon a time. Okay. Rightio. So, yeah, so moving on to for today, a case example of male violence. So one of the main themes throughout this that I want to explore is how at the moment we tend to put a lot of focus on what to do after a problem has occurred. And I believe we don't put a lot of effort or energy or resources or money into trying to avoid those problems in the first place. And yeah, I think physical male violence is a good case example. So I'll just meander through that a little bit. I think we do so much in the way of articulating the problem, the justice system, the punishment system, and relatively speaking, so little on prevention and culture change, like not none in those areas, but very little. I'd say at the moment, almost everyone is aware of the problem. Like, I don't think it's going to come as a great shock or surprise to say that male type people tend to be the creators of much physical violence in this world. I don't think that's
too
much of a stretch. No.
No.
It gets a lot of media, and there's always pressure on more policing and tougher sentencing. And I guess on that front, like, we should all be very proud that there are now more men in jail than there ever has been before. Yay!
No.
Woohoo.
Yeah.
No. I mean, sure, but no.
I think a lot of folks haven't really thought a great deal about why men are violent. Or if you ask most folks, a lot of people think along the lines of, men, you know, what are you going to do? Like, they've got all that privilege and that's what they choose to do with it. What can you do?
It's a grown-up version of boys will be boys.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, men will be men. What can you do? So it's sort of a, like, even as I say this, the podcast listeners can't see me throwing, like, gesturing to the sky as if to say, you know, what can you do? It's almost like throwing your arms up in the air and giving up and just going, well, all we can really do is work on better police forces and better justice systems and bigger jails is pretty much the current strategy. So as a philosophy, it's kind of, if you scratch the surface a bit, people often talk about, and I'm very much paraphrasing here, essentially saying that men are kind of hardwired as assholes, and that all we can really do is put our resources into cleaning up the mess that they make, obviously such as their violence against women. And I guess I want to both agree and then disagree with that perspective. And I mean, like, ultimately, I don't really agree with it, but I think there's always a degree of truth in everything. So I just want to explore that first a little bit. So to agree with the idea that men are like that, I think our genetics, to a degree, does influence our personalities. And if you look at sort of what we've been genetically selected for over the last whatever, wherever you measure from, 100,000, million years, then there is the argument that there, if there's such a gene for, say, violent and rapey behaviour, that that has a genetic advantage in that the colonising rapey force will move through a country or a culture or a community and replicate itself, which is a fucking horrible thought. But there's an argument there for that. And I have no idea whether this is true or not, but it's I've read that something like 3% of us have got DNA from Genghis Khan. So if ever there was a star performer.
Well, I mean, look at anyone who's colonized anywhere.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the model.
Pretty much the model, yeah.
Come in, conquer, rape the natives, off you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you win.
Yeah. So there's an argument that, you know, if you're like one of the nice guys just sitting around waiting, hoping that someone will hit you up on Messenger or whatever existed 100,000 years ago, you're going to genetically lose to the Genghis Khans of the world who sweep through the, let's say, the alphas. So in the same way that you can breed certain qualities into plants and all other animals, you could say that over the course of generations, we've wanted our men to be fighters and aggressors, and that those types of folks have had an evolutionary advantage in a sort of a survival of the fittest, or like most aggressive or most oversexed or whatever. There is a counterpoint, which is to say, if you've got a community which is collaborative, peace-loving, kind, and nurturing and communicative, they're actually much more likely to be a very stable, secure community over time, and they're much more likely to help each other out and bring up the kidlets, etc., etc. So there is a counter argument, but yeah,
you could divide that on gender lines though, and you only need one half of the population to actually be that way. You don't actually need both halves of the population to be that way.
True. And actually, there's an argument, I think, that our species has, quote, specialized, unquote, over time, so that like the female side are more likely to be doing that nurturing, caring kind of stuff. Oh, this whole conversation makes me sick. It's so stereotyped. and the male folk have been stereotyped to go out and shoot and hunt and kill. And I'm talking about other humans more than tonight's meat.
Well, I think it's both, because competition versus feeding you. So
I guess just to fully explore that counterpoint, if you had a culture where all of the people were into that collaborative, supportive, caring about the community kind of vibe, maybe they would also have a strong genetic advantage. I don't know. But as a counterpoint, yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense.
All right. So that's me agreeing with the point. To disagree with the point, I would say that who we are, like, and our personalities are a mix of our genetic makeup and, much more importantly, our socialization. This is just nature versus nurture, and I think everyone agrees that if we're on a spectrum there, I think everyone agrees that we are on a spectrum. It's just a question of like where we actually think we are, and we can disagree. It doesn't matter too much exactly where the line is, but I know for myself, I suggest that socialization is much stronger than genetics, and I say that as an example. If it was true, so I'm cis male, if it was true that we're, you know, completely different beings, and because of my male DNA, I naturally have some kind of affinity or magic connection with all people like me, then in theory, I should be able to pop over to a country. I'm just going to pick like Africa as a country with a vastly different social landscape to the one I grew up in, and one where I conveniently I actually was for a month last year, so I got to test this out a little bit. And even like going back in time to say, like, I don't know, the 50s or the 1850s or something, in theory, I would have this magical natural affinity and ability to get along with folks like that. And I don't. I have much more capacity to get along with, say, folks like you who are brought up in a very similar cultural landscape to me and have been brought up around similar ideas. I'm sorry if I'm misrepresenting our friendships, but I feel like we can just like slip into conversations and know exactly where we're coming from and get along way more than I can with people that I share allegedly more genetic stock with.
I would agree. I don't really have a strong affinity with maternal, like the stereotypical woman type folk who stay at home and look after kids and do all that, which I should if it was gender-based.
Right. Bingo. Yep. Nice. Then from there, have you two heard about ACEs, so the Adverse Childhood Experiences Score?
No, I feel like I should.
No. I wouldn't regard myself as a specialist in the area, in this area. But essentially it's sort of saying there's a number of indicators of adverse experiences in childhood. And, you know, you can imagine the sort of stuff, physical abuse, sexual abuse, poverty, malnutrition, lack of housing, lack of parents, whatever. You can give people essentially a score as to how, what's the word I'm looking for, how high their ACEs score is. And that score almost entirely predicts what's going to happen to that person throughout the rest of their life.
Ooh, I'm fascinated.
I'm fascinated too. Like the connection is extreme. So to the point where researchers that are looking into this area sort of start to talk in terms of the question of, do any of us actually have free choice or like agency and governance over what we do? Because almost everything that we do is a result of what happens to us in childhood. One specific example I've got, I remember seeing some really solid research when Melbourne was having more of a heroin epidemic about 15, 20, 25 years ago. Over 90% of heroin users have got childhood sexual abuse. The link between those things is just extreme. It's just that the correlation, perhaps causation, between things is just really solid. And so the work people are doing on ACEs is making those correlations, those connections, really scientific. Another one we know, and this is quite uncomfortable to talk about, but almost all rapists have their own story of rape to talk about. It's just violence. Another example.
Begets violence.
Violence begets violence. Yes, absolutely. And sexual assault begets sexual assault. And lastly, like your level of exposure to the justice system, the criminal justice system, is almost entirely defined by how you're treated. So circling out this argument, even if there is a genetic, well, there is a genetic side to our behavior, we know this, but even if you've got the genetic markers for certain behavioral characteristics or types, we know that whether or not those genes are activated, turned on or turned off, depends on what happens to you in childhood in particular. So again, it's socialization that is the more strong, in my opinion, governing agent there. Inga, you look thoughtful.
Does that mean if you can be socialized into a behavior, you can be socialized out of a behavior?
I certainly believe that to be the case. I mean, I feel like I've got an example to mind. I have a couple of beautiful friends who for reasons, find themselves taking on some three kids who came to them really challenged. And let's just think of them in terms of like, you know, extended family or something like that. And initially the diagnosis or the sense of like, the hope or the best case scenario for those kids didn't look great, but just the act of providing a very consistent, caring, very intentional environment has just so absolutely radically changed those kids from, like, for sure being at an incredible level of disadvantage and disability through to being so much more stable. I don't know, just a little example that comes to mind. So coming back to the question of violent men, obviously I think it goes without saying we are all accountable for our actions and society needs to be protected, so there's absolutely an argument for doing something about violent men, violent people, but violent men is what we're talking about, including separating them. So what I'm about to say is not a proposal that we just ignore personal responsibility and let people off the hook, just to be clear. however, when it comes to punishing people for crimes and sort of exacting revenge on them, which is basically all our current criminal justice system is set about doing. It's not just about separating dangerous people. We all know it's very much about punishing them. It's about making that time as awful as possible, which is apparently a motivator. when you think about, like, obviously, yes, we are accountable for our actions, but when you bear in mind that our actions are the results so much of what happens to us in earlier years, it just seems a little misguided to punish someone for things that they've already been punished for. Like separating them, making community safe, holding people accountable, yes, absolutely, fuck yes. But the punishment side of it just seems a little on the misguided side.
Yes, it's not fixing the problem.
No. And then when you factor in the costs, so specifically to put someone in jail, it costs in Australia about $250,000, $250,000 to convict someone. And then to hold them in jail, it costs $140,000 per year. So when you think about it in those terms, not only is it misguided, it's also really expensive. And obviously, that's not to count for the impacts on the victim, the financial impacts on the victim. And if we're talking about violent crime, rape, etc., we know that the impacts of that on a victim are anything from mild through to life-ending. And, you know, you can take figures from insurance companies on what a life is worth. This is, like, really crude, and it depends on how old the person is and so forth, but we're talking about figures way into the millions of dollars on the victim side of things. The only reason I was looking more specifically into the costs of locking up a perpetrator or the person that's caused harm is just because those figures are really obvious and tangible and they're really known. But obviously the costs are huge is my point. Little side story here. I know that the podcast attracts quite a few benevolent dictators. So just a little pro tip for all the benevolent dictators out there. In your country, if you just use 20% of the cost of imprisonment to identify who's at risk and then give them the services they need at a younger age and then spend the balance of the 20% on their universal basic income, you will basically have a country free of crime. Just a little pro tip for you there. Anyway, back to the plot. So it seems to be misguided and expensive. It's also ineffective. Like, we all know that jail just doesn't work. Like, we all know that you're more likely to be further involved with the criminal justice system once you've been involved once. It's just, we all know that. That doesn't need any explaining, and yet we're still so addicted to that model.
There's no rehabilitation.
Very little.
Yeah.
Very little. So, yeah, it's misguided, it's expensive, and it's ineffective, and yet we keep crying for more. And I think that a part of what's going on there is that we just don't want to look at the causes. And by the causes, I mean the adverse experiences that boys and men experience and the fact that it's more complicated than just a privilege story. By which I mean, if you want to look into that, it challenges the notion of just saying, oh, man, what a bunch of privilege, what a bunch of dicks. If we want to look into it, we've got to go, oh, there's something more complicated going on there than just a privilege story.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying the series. I do this for the love of it, but there is something I'd like your help with. I'd love it if you can share this with someone. At some stage during this series, when someone comes to mind that might be interested, please go right ahead and click the share button. I'm aware that in some circles this can be pretty contentious material, so here's a tip. You don't have to say, hey, I love this, you will too. You can just say, there's some food for thought here, or something similarly ambiguous and non-committal. It's all good. So yeah, at some stage during this series, please share it with someone. Now, back to the content.
So, how are we going so far? Are we making enough sense so far?
I think so, yes. Yep.
Great. So I've been painting a scenario here where I'm sort of saying we're not spending any money on that, and perhaps the listener is wondering if that's actually the case, and maybe there's an assumption that we do actually spend an awful lot of money on men, trying to catch them before they fall and providing support services and care and so forth. Have you ever heard, looking at Emma and Inga, have you ever heard about campaigns to stop violence against women? Like, for instance, the White Ribbon mm-hmm. campaign?
Yes.
Yes. I imagine you have. Because literally every Australian government has at least a strong statement about violence against women, but more generally speaking, a well-funded or very well-funded campaigns. Not well-funded enough, but literally every government at the state and federal level in the 20 or so years that I've been following the issue has got a very active campaign about stopping violence against women. So bearing in mind what we know about violence begets violence, and what we know about what I was talking before about ACEs scores and so forth, and how almost all male violence can be tracked back to how those men were treated either as men or as boys, have you ever heard of a campaign to stop violence against boys and men?
Boys under family violence, but it comes under the family violence, domestic violence kind of bucket. And, you know, there's domestic violence kind of, the domestic violence policies aren't women specific usually. Though there are women shelters more than there are men shelters, and the women shelters, you know, children are allowed in those up to a certain age, but not the same. No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have looked quite extensively, and I've never found at a government level anything that looks like a campaign to stop violence against men, ever. Not in Australia, not in any government around the world that I've been able to find.
No. There are some for mental health, which arguably are connected. Totally connected, but not in a, you know, if you're experiencing violence as a man, these are things you can access, or if you're experiencing the urge to be violent as a man, here are some resources you can access.
There's some for that. There's some to catch men at the point in time where they're considering causing women harm. There's some services pitched around that, but they're not so much around saying if you as a male type person have experienced violence in your life, then we care. It's important. It's valid. Yep. And
we believe you.
Yeah, we believe you. Let's talk about it. And I guess at this point in time, when I chat about this stuff with people, a lot of folks feel like services are delivered sort of according to need. So the response is, well, you know, women receive so much more violence than men, so of course there's more services that are pitched towards women.
Which is missing the point.
I was going to say, also, is that actually true?
It is not actually true.
Yeah.
Even if we include intimate partner violence, men receive twice as much physical violence overall. So if we were providing services just based on need, there would be at least two services for men for every one service for women. And I know that will be a bit of a shock to a lot of listeners, so I encourage you very much to do your own research on that. So by which I mean, do some searches. This is only takes 5 minutes to prove or disprove what I just said. Do your own research on patterns of violence by gender, but make sure you go to the source documents. So go to police, go to courts, go to government. Data as opposed to interpretive articles, because not many places will publish that information, but it's all quite obviously there. So it's the absence of attention and awareness that I believe creates future problems. So yeah, as we've been saying, violence begets violence. And more specifically, I would say, not only do men, it would seem, receive more violence, the violence they receive isn't generally acknowledged, and it's not generally properly responded to. It's not taken seriously, and we don't generally provide support and care for it. And the thing that really begets more violence is how well a situation is responded to. Like, we know this when something happens to us, if trauma or harm occurs, how the people and community around you respond is a really important part of how much you internalize that or how much you process it and work through it.
If we wanted to flip the gender kind of example, the low numbers of women reporting sexual assault would be a good gender flipped example, in that women don't report sexual assault as much because they're not believed and the system is really hard and those kind of things. For men, that's all violence. Not just sexual violence.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, also, though, I'm just thinking, you know, today I was just walking through the schoolyard and I saw a boy with a black eye and it was like, oh, God, I wonder what happened to him. But it wasn't a big pushing me go, oh, my God, I've got to go and see how that's going. Whereas I was just sitting here thinking about it and thinking, had I seen a girl with a black eye, I would go, whoa, what is going on?
Oh, right.
You know, whereas for him, I sort of looked at him and went, oh, yeah, I've taught him before. He's a bit of a rough nut. Like, I'm guessing he's got in a punch on somehow. And it's like, well, that's sad that would be, you know, far more normal and fine and just how it is.
Yeah.
You know, like,
boys being boys.
Yeah.
Or something. But, beautiful. You know, he, yeah.
Beautiful example. I mean, not beautiful, but great example.
Yeah, sad. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about, have you ever heard, like, you've watched the news or whatever, and, you know, terrorist shooting in blah, 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 kills 43 people, including women and children?
Yeah. Not like, all the poor
we
men.
We specify the ones we care about.
Yeah.
So I think, evidence of our just frankly lack of care about, boys will be boys. Who cares? Don't deal with it. They don't deal with it. They go and punch someone up later in life, or they go and shoot up a school. This is the whole point. a couple of little relevant tangents on this topic. I've seen research, so it was a while ago, showing that babies that are held close and like cuddled and nurtured more are less likely to be violent further in life, older in life. And I've also seen evidence that there's other parallels, like lab rats that are not groomed by their mother are more likely to be ill and angry. And what do you know? We've also discovered that we don't hold boys as close as we do girls. I remember some research where they got a plastic doll with no gender, wrapped it up in blue, and just like watched what people did with it. And people were much more likely to put it down, hold it at arm's distance, and talk in like distant language to it. And you swaddle the same plastic doll in pink, and people are much more likely to hold it and embrace it and coo and say all lovely things and sing and all that sort of stuff. So that right there, like, it happens at an incredibly young period of age, that separation. So that's one tangent. We also know, and again, listeners, feel free to go do some research. We also know that kids that are spanked by their parents are much more likely to be violent in adulthood And what do you know? Guess what gender gets banked more? Yeah, and it's still the case that boys in school are likely to receive some sort of a variant of like the man up message when they experience difficulties like bullying or teasing or violence or sexual assault or harassment. So, in summary, it's not remotely hard to articulate why men are violent. Like, I actually don't think anything we've just been talking about for the last half an hour or whatever. None of that is actually that revolutionary or breakthrough. I think on some level, most of us know that stuff. And the cause and effect, like the consequences of stuff, I don't think there's, you know, the social science around that is pretty solid these days. I don't think much of that is a revolution. But it is almost impossible to get attention or funding for that stuff. And I notice even in talking about it a couple of times as we've been talking, I've had that critic on myself just going, oh my God, banging on about poor men's issues. Like I've got that internal dialogue for myself. And that's just at this level. Imagine if you want to actually put out to the world for funding for a program to stop violence against boys and men or something like that, or to look after them and take care. Like if you've ever raised your hand and said that you want to focus on the issues that men face, or you want funding for programs to help men, then you know what happens next. You will be ridiculed, you'll be rejected, you'll be laughed at, you'll be told that you're entitled, you'll be told that you deserve it, and if you have a dick, you will absolutely suffer jokes at the expense of your dick. It's understandable, but it's suicide. By which I mean, I understand why people are angry and frustrated. And I understand that a lot of people operate from a sense of, God, there's already, there's so much privilege in the men camp and you want us to give more is like kind of the response that people have sometimes. So I do understand the how hard it is to like want to look at some of this stuff. But unfortunately, I just think it's suicide not to, by which I mean by ignoring this stuff, we're creating problems for the next generation of women, if that's what you care about. I also think men, but
people,
yeah. People.
Like, if you, I'm guessing what you mean is equity and equality means all of them, not just some.
I think there's that, and I think that I mean that if we don't pay attention to this issue of how much violence happens to boys and men and how much we ignore it and normalize it, we are creating future problems in that those boys and men, like the problem doesn't go away, they just internalize it. And eventually an explosion occurs, and it's either an internal explosion, their own suicide, or it's an outward explosion of violence against whoever happens to be handy at the time.
Yeah.
So when I say like we collectively are committing a sort of form of suicide against ourselves, where we're creating mess for us in the future by ignoring this stuff.
Prevention is better than the cure, huh?
Oh my God. And cheaper.
It makes economic sense.
It does. Shout out to the economists in the listening audience. And I guess like speaking of the audience, I guess like if you're listening to this and you're already at the point of like, oh, this is uncomfortable territory, then that's like another example of what I'm talking about our collective disinterest in hearing about this stuff. That's like just like further evidence. So that's kind of why I'm doing this podcast series. I want to look at the causes of these problems and not just articulate the problems, although I totally acknowledge that articulating the problems is an absolutely crucial first step. And I think that even though I've just articulated like that path around male violence, I don't think, as I say, much of that is terribly confusing, although some of it will be new to some. I think despite that, I'm probably already in the process of being unsubscribed by a certain number of folks. And I guess my thinking is just, I think there's a reasonable chance that I have some contributes to make in this series on where the gender revolution needs to go potentially from here to start addressing what I said at the start around, in some ways we are regressing, or at least have paused and faltered. And I genuinely think there may be some ideas coming up that are relevant to that. Some of what I'd like to say is going to be wrong. Some of it may be right. And I just simply feel like I'd rather lose a few subscribers if it means potentially contributing something useful.
All you're doing, I think the conversation is so important. If I were sitting here disagreeing with you, which I'm not in this case, but if I were, that's still a totally important situation to be in, to sort of go, all right, well, what are the viewpoints? What are we looking at? What are, you know, obviously what we're doing so far isn't working. Like, very obviously, it's not working at all. And so to keep going, oh, well, we should just keep doing the same thing, is completely ridiculous. So, you know, to even to sit here, if anyone's thinking, oh, this is rubbish, I don't agree, that's great. Don't agree. Bring it on. Think about it more. Like, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think about that.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I mean, objectively, putting a problem solver hat on, you define the problem, your next step is root cause analysis. So what you're suggesting is a very logical path. And unless you understand the root causes, you're putting Band-Aid on Band-Aid on Band-Aid. So we've got so far, great. And that's helped us uncover more of what the problems actually are, to where we are today. So we can actually, it's way more obvious what the problems are. They're not hidden behind lots of pretend things anymore, and it's getting worse. So logically, this is the next step of looking at root cause.
I sort of think of this as, instead of addressing what we're doing at the moment, which is the problems men create, I sort of think of this in terms of addressing the things that create problematic men.
Mm.
And yeah, just to be super clear, I am not challenging our general understanding of gender problems. I absolutely agree with them. And my focus is just on the solutions. I think that takes us, this is going to take us to some really interesting spots, and also some really challenging spots. But yeah, I think the way we look at the problem and the filters we use as we look at it are at the moment making it impossible to see the solutions.
Our unconscious biases are being a bit loud.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I guess the good news is I'm looking forward to walking us all through it sort of step by step and showing my workings and pointing you towards your own research there. And I absolutely intend to conclude with forwards-looking ideas on where to from here. And I don't know if it's overly optimistic to say it's all good.
Could be not shit. Yeah. I don't know about all good.
Great. So from here, for the rest of this episode, I'd like to do just a little bit more by way of introduction and background about myself, which is mostly for the listeners' benefit. So for this episode, I would like to say thank you so much, Emma and Inga, for your input, and I look forward to getting into it with you.
Yay.
Yay, indeed.
Okay, so I know that some of you will want to know a little bit more about me and my identity and my journey to get here, so you can sort of contextualize some of my comments. So I've let Emma and Inga go, and I'm just going to tell you a little more about myself, and then going to finish this episode with some sort of balancing comments or reflections I've had while I was in the editing process. So yeah, by way of context, as at the time of recording, I'm a 52-year-old white middle-class male. And yes, I am aware of the irony of that, and more on that in just a second. I would say I have been feminist since about the age of 12. To me, in my opinion, the core themes of that just seemed absolutely self-evident and not even worthy of debate. I guess in my early 20s, I moved into what we then thought of, or what I then thought of, as sort of cross-dressing, because we didn't really have a non-binary world back then. And I did assume that I was on a trans path. I've spoken about this more previously, so I won't do a huge deep dive here. But yeah, look, it turns out it wasn't so much that I needed to be, I didn't have gender dysphoria. It's not that I needed to be in a woman's body. It's just, frankly, that I didn't like men. And I was looking to differentiate myself from that. And yeah, back in those days, we didn't have non-binary or queerness. So, eventually, I discovered those things, and I also made peace with being cis male. And to a degree, as a part of that, I also had to learn to care for men and also men's issues, because on some level, I am also a man, although I'm a bit of a, I don't like to think of myself as having gender. On another level, obviously, I do. So yeah, on that, I think of my gender on as having sort of four levels to it: the physical, the psychological, what I'm attracted to, and where my politics lie. And so yeah, physically, I've made peace with the fact that I'm in a male body, and that feels right to me. So that makes me cis male as opposed to trans. Psychologically, I don't identify with the concept of gender. I don't want to be seen by my gender, or limited by my gender, and I don't want to see the rest of the world that way either, but that's another story. So yeah, psychologically and in terms of my personality, I think of myself as non-binary, so not on the binary scale of male or female, or just as being agendered, like not having a gender. In terms of my attraction, I think of myself as pansexual these days, although like most of my history was kind of more hetero-shaped, just because of socialization. And in terms of my politics, I think of myself as pan-political, which is to say that most of the time on a good day, I am reasonably well informed about the gender issues that affect most people, and I will go into bat for all genders. So I'm not one-sided, I'm not one way or the other, or going in for any particular gender as the gender or the issues that I'm looking onto. So yeah, that also means that in a polarized world where most people are either advocates for women's issues or men's issues or sometimes minority gender issues, pretty much everyone can see me at various times as their opposition, and that's fine by me. It's really important to me to be on everyone's side, which also at times means that I'm not one-sided and I'm not exclusive. I just want to say a little more around my beliefs or my values and so forth. Obviously, I'm a huge advocate that no one should be judged by their gender. That's probably pretty self-evident by now. And that's true for me to the point where I will ignore gender as long as I possibly can in other people. I think that's a good default position for me to take. The gods know I am in favour of undoing traditional roles, traditional gender roles, to the point where I'm in some circumstances in favour of quotas, which as a feminist makes me pretty extreme. And yeah, speaking of feminism, I'm sort of with the 70s feminists in that the personal is political, meaning that I try and match my walk to my talk. I am sex positive, meaning that if an activity is between folks that consent to that activity, it's fine by me. I'm also very heavily informed by non-violence. I was actually a part of a non-violent community safety and peacekeeping group for, 6 or 7 years in my 20s. I have received and taught a lot of non-violence training. It's very important to me. I've been studying psychology and counselling for about 25 years, and almost all of my podcasts I listen to and books is sort of social landscape stuff or psychology stuff. I do also have a small counselling practice, which mostly is about dealing with the consequences of sexual harm, I guess you could say. And I'm also very trauma-informed. Yeah, and lastly, I guess, at some stage quite a long time ago, so early 20s, I made a decision that if I was going to stick around, it was important to me to live my ethics and to a reasonable extent be a part of solutions. So, you know, I've been vegan and vegetarian for a lot of my life. Now I'm just a hypocrite. I've avoided plane and car travel for a lot of my life. Yeah. And in fact, my entire business, so Curious Creatures, which I've recently finished up, arguably that entire business was built around the core theme of how do we fix the problems that women are facing in this world, particularly regarding relationships and sexuality. And in truth, it wasn't just about the problems women face, because there are also problems men face, but yeah, it's important to me to be part of solutions. So, yeah, I wanted to tell you those things, particularly because as a male voice speaking to the topic of gender, you know, it could be argued I need to establish some credibility, and I need you to see, or you need to see, that I didn't just wander into this topic because I was bored during COVID and didn't have anything to do, or that I'm just kind of, you know, resenting giving up my male privileges and wanting to go back to the 50s or something like that. Couldn't be farther from how I identify. So if I need to, at the end of each episode, once I've gone through the editing process, I'm just going to add in any extra comments or thoughts at the end. For the most part, for the dialogue itself, the conversations we have with Emma and Inga, I'm wanting to leave those conversations just exactly sort of as they happened as much as possible, so that you can sort of hear and feel the pauses and so forth. Yeah, and I'll put any balancing comments or thoughts at the end as much as possible. So a couple of balancing comments today. First one is around when I'm talking about violence against boys and men, I very much include violence from other boys and other men. And a lot of the time when we're talking about violence, we don't include this because it's not what we regard as, quote, gendered violence, unquote. And we tend to put more importance and emphasis on that form of gendered violence. However, I believe that when we say that, we fail to spot the impact of those forms of violence. And we also, on some level, it's a very dismissive message. It sort of says, what happened to you is okay, it's normal, we're not going to worry about it too much. And although it might make a difference to us, and it might, in our mind or your mind, feel like a very different and lesser form of violence, I want to propose it doesn't make difference to the person that is being harmed. And they're not going to spot the nuance of that difference. It's still going to create problems for them. And it's also, it actually feels like a form of gaslighting to me, and it sort of kills our ability to identify a very important source of later problematic behaviours. So yeah, including all forms of violence when I talk about that. Next clarifying point is when I said something like, not many places will publish that information. So I was talking about, violence against men or male type people. And what I meant by that was that a lot of the media around us can't or won't publish information that shows that men are struggling or that men in some ways have it worse. So just as a little tiny example of that, at the moment, if you do a bit of searching around gender and homelessness here in Australia, most of what you'll see is the media reporting that women are the fastest growing group of homeless people. But when you go to the source data, that'll show you that, yes, there is truth in that. But despite that fact, far more homeless people are men than women. And also the types of homelessness that men experience is generally a lot worse. So it's more likely to be sleeping rough rather than, say, at the other end of the scale,
insecure accommodation. So yeah, that's what I meant by I say like most places won't publish that information. So my suggestion is to go to the sources of data wherever possible. So here in Australia, I find that information put out by the police, statistics from court, the court and justice systems, and government statistics in Australia seem to me to be pretty good, or at least freer of bias. Third clarifying point is there's a couple of times where I laugh at kind of slightly confusing or possibly odd moments, and I don't think it comes across wrong, but I just wanted to clarify. So one of them is when I'm talking about the costs of the impacts of harm on the victim compared to the person causing harm. There's a moment there where I laughed that struck me as a bit odd. And I just want to clarify, it's not because that's funny. I'm actually just incredulous at how extreme the cost is, and how when you lay out the numbers like that, like I'm kind of face-palming and just going, how are we not paying more attention to this? It is ludicrous. And that's to say nothing about the horror of the individual stories within that. I just want to be clear, I'm not laughing at that. Okay, and lastly, I just want to address two kind of critical responses that are bouncing around in my head as I listen to this stuff. One of them is a response I've received when I've spoken about some of this stuff in the past, which is to say, yeah, maybe you've got some points there, but just now is not the time. Like, this is insensitive in the current climate. And I guess I just wanted to respond to that by saying, in my experience, it's never the time. Like, there's always, this topic always has that sense of urgency, and something awful has always just happened. It's like we're in a state of trauma around this almost the entire time. So it's almost never the time. So in practice, this topic almost never gets explored. There's a bit of a sense of, yeah, just hang on, we'll get to that in a minute. But in my experience, over 30 years, that minute never arrives. And so I'm starting to regard that perspective as almost kind of like a cover for sort of saying, I don't want to hear what you're saying, or I don't want to hear this. And the second critical response is something around my style of delivery is not right, like it's too logical, or it's too emotional, or it's too whatever. And in some ways I think my response is pretty similar to my last one, which is to say I think that's probably a cover. I mean, not necessarily. There might be some, there's probably a lot I can learn about the way I present stuff. But I think it might also be a cover. Look, this is my style. I've done my best. This is at least my 10th attempt to get this material out. I've got into it a lot of times and sort of stopped myself and filtered myself because, in my opinion, my style hasn't been perfect. But at some stage, I've just got to say, hey, gang, here's my thoughts. Here's my style. Agree, disagree. I love you. Bye for now.